Welcome back, my friends, to Chronology. It's been far too long, and technically this one doesn't really count with our mission statement, but we're back, and we're happy to be back. It's me, casual wrestling fan Dave Thackera, and that guy over there, that's Neil Trauma. Neil, how are you?
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in. Chronology is back. I'm doing great. It's WrestleMania season, which is the greatest time of year to be a wrestling fan. Even, you know, I'm in the boat where I think that the current product just doesn't live up to this old stuff that I love talking about, but it still is a great time to be a wrestling fan. I'm so psyched for WrestleMania. We're recording this on actual WrestleMania weekend. I don't know for sure when you guys out there in a podcast land are going to be listening to us, but I am stoked for the fact that it is WrestleMania weekend. Dave, how about you?
This is not a classic quote-unquote typical Chronology. Peacock Network is now the home of WWE, and they've uploaded a bunch of Raws from the past, but not the Raws that we're currently in the midst of reviewing episode by episode. So we like doing the podcast enough where we're just gonna say screw it, we're gonna do a WrestleMania. Maybe it'll be a one-off deal until they get on their feet with all of the stuff, or maybe it'll just be the last podcast we do for a while. Time will tell about that. But we're here to talk about WrestleMania 9, what we've been referring to in the episodes that we have recorded as a giant craptacular, the world's largest toga craptacular. And after watching it, I kind of know why it has that reputation. Although I will defend it, and I'm sure we'll get to that. So what do you say we just jump right in to WrestleMania 9 at Caesars Palace, Nevada. Took place April 4th, 1993. Because I didn't do any research for this part of it. That was the only thing that happened in the world that day. But Neil, we've recapped extensively what led up to this. Can you just explain to me one thing before we get started? Because this is the overarching storyline of the entire episode. I wonder if you know the backstory behind it. Hulk Hogan factored into this WrestleMania quite extensively, but he factored in with what looked like an actual broken face. Was that makeup? Do you know what happened to the Hulkster? We know what they told us happened to the Hulkster, but do you know what actually caused Hulk Hogan to show up with a black eye and it looked like he was in the hospital for a couple hours getting that taken care of the night before?
Well, I wasn't expecting you to hit me with this right off the bat. I thought we'd get to this story later on in the show, but I will say, to answer your question, as legend dictates, because as far as I know, this has never been confirmed, this has never been proven, but what allegedly happened was that Hulk Hogan and the Macho Man got into a legitimate fight in the days leading up to WrestleMania, and the Macho Man popped him in the face. And that's what led to the state of Hulk Hogan's face, with stitches and bruising. Yes, they explained it on the show that, you know, Money Inc. paid someone off to jump him in the gym. But yes, as the longstanding wrestling rumor, and it's just one of those longstanding rumors that's been around since the earliest days of the wrestling internet community, is that Macho Man popped the Hulkster in the eye in the days leading up to WrestleMania 9.
Was it because he had jealous eyes?
I mean, maybe it could have been. Was Macho and Liz may have been divorced by this point. I don't know. I lose track of things. But yeah, that is the story behind that. And I do have to say, before we do start Mania, because I know you want to jump right into it, but I wanted to just say two things off the bat, because my gimmick on this podcast is that I'm the longtime wrestling fan. So I do have strong feelings about this show, although I am a man with my heart and mind in completely separate places as it relates to this show, because my mind knows, in fact, now more than ever, that I've actually watched and critically reviewed the Raws leading up to this show, that it was a terribly built WrestleMania, and in execution, it's atrocious, which of course we'll get to. That's the whole point of this podcast. But my heart, Dave, actually holds a very special place in it for WrestleMania 9. It's one of the first Coliseum Video WWF VHS tapes I ever owned. And as I mentioned to you off air before we hit the record button, I have legitimately seen this show over 100 times. I have the commentary memorized. I know everything that happens on this show. As a kid, I loved it before I realized like what a pile of drizzling it was. But I do have a special place in my heart for this show. So I'm going to have very conflicting opinions as I tell you in every match how much I loved it and how terrible it was all at the same time.
All right. Well, again, I watched this in pieces over the course of a few days because I didn't have 3 hours to dedicate to a 20-something-year-old wrestling pay-per-view. So I will do the best I can with what I remember in order. But the thing that jumped out to me pretty closely is that we started this show with a brand new slash legendary member of the WWE family. Was this Jim Ross's very first broadcast, or was it only like, I know he wasn't on Raw leading up to this. Was he on any of the Saturday night shows, or was this the first time anyone in the world met JR WWE?
This was the first WWF appearance of Jim Ross. Jim Ross, longtime announcer for WCW, and before that, the NWA. And he's been around wrestling for years and years and years, came up with Mid-South, Bill Watts, all of that. But Jim Ross's first appearance, very, very first appearance with the WWF, is in fact on this show. And you know what, Dave? What we also should mention, we're like totally on separate pages, not separate pages, but before we do mention anything else about WrestleMania, because this beginning of WrestleMania is pretty wild, pretty newsworthy, and actually one of the best parts of the show, we should also warn our listeners, we are recording this after dark, and we are thus drinking on the show. You are drinking, right? Because I have a beer right here, and I've been waiting to crack it on the air.
Every once in a while, and I can't avoid it because of the way that this has worked out, and I'm not going to hold the mute button, every once in a while, you're going to hear this sound. That's the ice cubes tinkling around in my bourbon glass here.
Dave drinks a bourbon because he's classy, because I'm the exact opposite of classy. I'm drinking a Natty Light. I'm about six in. Here comes another one. Beautiful sound right there. I'm channeling my other podcast that I do, The Beer Breakfast, where I crack beers open on the air all the time. But anyway, let's get back to Mania 9. Dave's got his bourbon. I've got my beer. Yes, Jim Ross's very first appearance in the WWF. He shows up wearing a toga. Gorilla Monsoon, the usual play-by-play man, has been relegated to the quote-unquote host of WrestleMania. He just shows up for a couple segments here and there, also in a toga. I think it's actually because Gorilla kind of wanted to get out of the announcing role and into more of a retirement role at this stage, which is why they brought JR in. JR, also, if I'm not getting the timeline incorrect, and this is important in wrestling history, if I'm not getting the timeline incorrect here, JR was a little bit upset about the emergence of another announcer who was gaining some backstage roles in WCW, a young man from the AWA from Minneapolis by the name of Eric Bischoff, who I have a feeling we may talk about once or twice before we're done with this podcast.
So they started the show with a match that only the people in attendance saw. We call it the shower beer. The shower beer match. You know how, like, when you're getting ready to go out and that shower beer hits pretty good, you know? Well, this is the dark match shower beer of WrestleMania 9 with Tito Santana and Papa Shango in a singles match that sort of quickly came and went. But they worked all the kinks out of the entrances into the arena. But Tito Santana did defeat Papa Shango in a match that I guess was okay.
Yeah, Tito Santana beat Papa Shango. I believe you can see this if you care to search for it on YouTube, because I know I have seen it in my life. I also do love me a good shower beer. I own one of those things that you have a suction cup and you stick it to the wall of your shower so you can actually hold your beer while you're in the shower. And I will tell you that Tito Santana sets a bit of WrestleMania history here, because this dark match with Papa Shango, if you want to count it as a WrestleMania match, does mark the final WrestleMania appearance for Tito Santana slash El Matador, which is historic because Tito, up to this point, had appeared at each and every WrestleMania. And this win in the dark match over Papa Shango brought his record to an epic, epic 2-1-6. He has two wins, one double countout, and six losses for Tito Santana. Also famous because he won. In fact, it's been a long time since Tito's win, because he won the very first match at the very first WrestleMania.
All right.
Started off 1-0, and it's been all downhill from there for Tito.
Well, we actually started the pay-per-view with my wife and I were working in the kitchen doing some baking, and I put this on because I needed some background music. I needed to do my research for the show. And this was the point of the episode where my wife looked over at the iPad we were watching this on and saw Tatanka come out with Sensational Sherry. And she went, "Oh, God." And that's it. That was the extent of her contribution to WrestleMania 9. But Tatanka and Sensational Sherry were there to meet Shawn Michaels, who was there with Luna Vachon. And if I'm not mistaken, this is the first time we meet Luna, too. Luna and JR debuting on the same episode?
And yes, indeed, the very first appearance of Luna Vachon in the WWF. And I will say, Dave, I think you also got off easy that this is the thing that made your wife groan, because there was a doink match coming up in a few minutes. So you could have had it worse like I did.
Well, in a quite good match, I will say, because both Tatanka and Shawn Michaels, they know how to put a match together as far as the main event of WrestleMania goes, like the final matches, not the dark matches. I didn't actually hate this match. I didn't particularly love it, and I always hate it when countouts come into play for a championship. But it was, I don't know, Tatanka and Shawn Michaels put on a pretty good match to settle their feud.
They did. They have a real, I'm not going to say it's a really good match. It's a good match, but it's just, it's what plagues this whole WrestleMania. It's such a finish. And this is something that the WWE does all the time now, is they book the match first. And then it's like they wait until that afternoon to think, oh crap, how can we get out of this corner we booked ourselves into? Because it makes total sense that Tatanka's got this undefeated streak. So of course he deserves a shot at a title at WrestleMania. It makes all the sense in the world. The feud leading up to it makes a ton of sense. He kept beating him in non-title matches. But then they get to the show and they realize, oh crap, we don't want to take the title off Michaels, but we don't want to end the Tatanka streak. So our only choice is a really, really, really weak finish, which even it looked botched. Like the announcers didn't know what was happening. It's a really, really weird ending where I think the official word is that it's a count out, because they're brawling outside the ring and then Shawn rolls in and then Tatanka comes in and hits a move and then the referee acts like he's DQing him. It's a really, really weird finish. And it does sully what was a really good match. If they could have found a way to do a clean finish, like even, all right, maybe it's not clean, but like even, why not just have Luna interfere and have that somehow lead to the finish? Like do the DQ that way if you have to get out of the match somehow. But yeah, what they did, no.
Again, let's count how many times Neil says the words, what they did, no, throughout the rest of this episode. So after the Intercontinental Championship does not change hands after close to 20 minutes of match, we get introduced once again in pay-per-view style to the Steiner brothers, Rick and Scott in totally fab 90s outfits, dude, and the Head Shrinkers, Samu and Fatu with Afa in their corner, in again, a reasonably good match. Was it great? No, but it was a tag team match that sort of continued the episode, and people were still in their seats and cheering at the right times. It wasn't awful, but it wasn't anything to write home about.
Grading it on the WrestleMania 9 curve, it's great. You know, it's solid tag action, formula tag match, which is always great. I love tag team wrestling. And, you know, it was a babyface win on a big show. No problems at all with this match. And honestly, if you want to look at it as the total package of quality wrestling combined with a good finish, this might have actually been the best match on the entire card.
Yeah, my lasting impressions of this were, I kind of forgot how good Samu and Fatu were at like helping other guys put together a great match. Not to take anything away from the Steiner brothers, but I don't know. I was never really the biggest Scott Steiner fan, and Rick's okay. But, you know, the whole match to me, let's just say as I was baking in the kitchen, not a lot of things called my attention over to the match to stop what I was doing and continue with those thoughts, you know?
Well, I'll tell you two things, one about what you said and then one about the match that I think you'll find fun. The thing with the Steiners, you got to realize your fandom hits post the Steiners' best period. The Steiners' actual best period probably comes a little bit before this WWF run and a little bit after this WWF run when they end up back in WCW, which their style of wrestling was more suited for than the cartoon WWF world. By the time you became a bigger fan during the Attitude Era, and by that point, you know, I'm not gonna accuse them of injecting any foreign substances into their body, but let's just say that their muscles were a little bit too large by this point in time. So their quality of work in the ring had certainly diminished. But I will note that in this match is pretty historic because it's the first WWF appearance of Jim Ross calling something a slobber knocker. So there was that.
Yeah, they were all over good old JR, all over this episode, making fun of his Oklahoma roots, making fun of this, making fun of that. Throughout the entire pay-per-view, Bobby the Brain Heenan and Macho Man Randy Savage, to me, were the stars of it. Absolutely. I thought Macho, while he was probably on cocaine at the time with some of the things that he was saying and the energy level that he carried throughout the entire show, I thought Macho actually did a really good job of making a somewhat forgettable show move forward regularly.
Come on, Dave. We're not going to accuse people of using any substances here on this podcast. But you're right. And I think that's why I've seen this show over 100 times, because while the action in the ring is not always great, and while the booking is oftentimes horrible, the announcing is awesome and it's really entertaining. So it's a great show to just throw on, like you said, while you're like in the kitchen doing something, which honestly is how I consume most of my pro wrestling anyway, is I have it on in the background while I'm doing other things. And this is a great show for that, because JR is great and Randy Savage and Macho Man are spot on. Randy Savage and Bobby Heenan, I should say, are spot on and awesome throughout this whole thing. Love the commentary. And yeah, this match is kind of the start of it.
Well, speaking about wanting to do anything else while this episode is on, we've got the next match, which is Doink the Clown coming out and Crush. Doink the Clown and Crush, two of the biggest whiffs in 1990s WWE, as far as I'm concerned. Never really got the Crush gimmick. Definitely hated the Doink the Clown gimmick. Don't get me wrong, I love me a good bad guy, love me a good heel. Always hated Doink. And we got to watch them for close to 10 minutes, and I regret ever subjecting myself to that.
Well, and that's it. Like, Doink, heel Doink has a lot of, like, fans in these days now, because the gimmick had such great potential. It was never fully realized potential, honestly. I mean, Matt Bourne was a great worker, but he had kind of, you know, trailed off a little bit at this point in his career, you know, under the makeup as Doink. It had potential to be a really good gimmick, but just the vision of it is so cartoony that it is one of those things where, like, if you're watching it, no matter how good the gimmick is, if your, like, friend or your family member that doesn't watch wrestling walks into the room and sees it, it's just like a roll of the eyes and a groan and why are you watching this, you idiot, kind of reaction. And then the whole storyline was that this stupid clown beat up this big tough guy, and then the big tough guy was gonna kill him at WrestleMania, and instead Doink gets the heat on Crush for like half the match and then wins, and they extend the feud. This never should have happened. Crush should have destroyed him in like 2 minutes. And then even if after that you want to bring out the second Doink and do some little crazy antics, you could. But it's not like you were really going to kill Doink's heat. Like, the Doink heat isn't in that he wins all the time. The Doink heat is in that he's an evil clown who can do evil things and then get beat up for it. That's what the gimmick is. And this big Crush, who actually had a lot of potential, this kills Crush. Like, Crush's career literally ends in that moment when he gets pinned by Doink at WrestleMania, in my opinion. Like, any great potential Crush had ends right in that moment. And this is the first time on the show where you're starting to be like, what was it that I said? Oh, this finish, what were they doing?
Do we know who was booking this this pay-per-view? Do we know who was actually in charge of calling?
The answer is always Vince.
I'm 100% sure it was Vince at the end, which we will get to. But yeah, all right. So that match, steaming pile that it was, mercifully, didn't really last all that long. Again, less than 10 minutes. All right. It's a pay-per-view. It's WrestleMania. It's the highlight of the year. You got to give these guys their time. But we've given them enough time.
Yeah. 10 minutes was 8 minutes too long.
Moving on. Match number 4 of the actual episode. We've got Razor Ramon against Bob Backlund in a match. Once again, to keep harping on the same chord, I didn't really care about. I don't know what the heat was behind Razor Ramon and Bob Backlund, other than
none.
I guess Vince was doing Bob a favor to put him on the show and give him a payday. It was a short match, and it sort of stunk up the place for about 5 minutes.
But now, wait a minute, Dave. You forgot the best part before the match starts is Todd Pettengill in one of many segments out in the crowd at WrestleMania, which I love Todd. He's out there in his stupid toga. He looks like the biggest idiot on earth. And he decides he's going to interview the Japanese photographers that are there and ask them if, you know, they thought there were two Doinks, because we glossed over this, by the way. The finish of the Doink match involved another guy dressed as Doink getting involved in the match and coming out from under the ring. And then it's a evolving theme throughout the rest of the show. Bobby Heenan as the heel insisting that it was a magic trick, an illusion, and there weren't actually two doinks. So that's what Todd's doing out there. He's interviewing these Japanese photographers who seem to know no other words except Yokozuna. They're really excited when he drops that one on them. But I love that moment. Yeah, the Razor Bob Backlund match is a nothing match. The older WrestleManias, like, you go and throw on like 5, 6, 7 on Peacock right now, you'll see that there's a lot of this because those shows were really long. And the thing was, they would just throw everybody on the card and tons of matches happened for no reason. They sort of started to get away from that from WrestleMania 9 onwards. But this is your homage, if you will, to those old WrestleManias. It's just two guys they wanted to put on the card. Razor was heavily pushed. They didn't want to leave him off the card. So he gets to beat Bob Backlund in a couple of minutes. I have no problem with this. You know, as far as offensive things on this show goes, this match is very, very far down on the list.
Well, now we get to one of the headline matches. The reason you guys are all here, drink your milk and say your prayers, because Hulk Hogan's coming out. It's Hulkster and Brutus, the Mega Maniacs, against Money Incorporated in, from my recollection of the Raws that we've done so far, probably the biggest build of the entire WrestleMania, Road to WrestleMania action was for this match, which isn't really saying a lot because I think they only drew it out like 4 episodes beforehand. I feel like this one had a pretty short runway, but here we are. Money Inc. retaining against the Mega Maniacs by disqualification in this one.
Yeah, which is, I mean, it's, this match is really nothing great. They did the best with what they could. It's Hogan in a tag match, which is probably the appropriate use of Hogan at this point. And wait till we get to the end of the show. But, you know, I gotta know, Dave, how can we can't talk about this match without talking a little bit about the end of the show. I think anyone who's listening to this podcast at this point knows how WrestleMania 9 ends. So we're not exactly going to spoil it. You, however, my friend, did not know how WrestleMania 9 ended. So I got to ask you at this point, because when we talked on our last podcast, I asked you what you thought was going to happen. And you assumed that the Mega Maniacs would win the titles. So when this happened and Money Inc. retained and then Hogan still did his pose down, did you have any thought or indication of what may occur later? Or did you think this is just how it was going to end?
I had no clue. I thought that the reason that that happened was that Hogan sort of was begged to come back to this WrestleMania to try to save some of it. I know that every time he's even on the card, he's got to do a whole lot of Hulkster stuff and he's got to Hulk out and he's got to do the pose and the ear, you know, let me hear you. And I know he's got to go through all of the Hulk Hogan tropes. So I thought that this match was just one giant way to showcase how good Money Inc. were at actually wrestling and to also give Hulk Hogan his time in the spotlight. And I thought it was in the middle of the show. So it was a nice opportunity for Hulkster to come, for Hulkster to do his thing, and for Hulkster to be on a limo and on a private plane back to wherever his house is before like he had to fight traffic or anything like that. That's what I thought was going to happen. So a disqualification where, yeah, the Mega Maniacs, you know, are doing their thing, but Money Inc. still gets the belts. I'm telling you, I thought it was absolutely perfect, not knowing what was coming up.
Yeah, if wishing only made it so. So let's put a pin in it, and we'll get back to the booking of this match when we talk about the end of the show, because I do have a lot to say, but I think it goes better if we talk about both of those things together. So we had kind of thought that we would only get this far on the podcast. I think we can keep going, my friend.
Yeah, we're pretty much cruising through this.
What's now, the next I will match? Say
that as I did watch this episode over multiple nights, I picked it up from here tonight, and then I watched it the rest of the way. Oh. So this is kind of fresh in my mind, whereas everything that came before this was a little bit hazy and fuzzy. Match number 6, Lex Luger, the Narcissist, coming out. And I will say this probably could have only happened on a pay-per-view in the early 1990s with the bevy of scantily clad women in horror of horrors, G-strings, coming out with mirrors to the stage. all, I'm telling you, when I was 12 years old and this was happening, I don't know if I would have left my room for about a week after I saw the entrance of the narcissist.
I do love Macho Man's reaction is pretty excellent as he's oogling over the girls.
Have you met the Macho Man?
And then Bobby Heenan chimes in with, yeah, Luger looks great, doesn't he? I love that moment. And Randy's ready to smack him. We really, you know what, we talked about how great they were, but we glossed over so much goodness with the announcers so far on this podcast. Because how about the beginning? We didn't even mention this. In the beginning of the show, they do a whole Roman procession to enter the arena. And Macho Man comes in on being carried by these like centurions, and he's got these women, these Vestal virgins, feeding him grapes. It's the most preposterous but awesome thing at the same time. And then Bobby the Brain comes in riding backwards on a camel, which is just a legendary moment, an awesome moment. And the joke plays out throughout the entire show as they keep commenting that Bobby smells like a camel and the camel scared him to death. I think there's a point where Macho suggests he go to the back, and Bobby says, I can't go back there. That camel is still here. I love it. I love so much about it. Yeah, they're great on the show. And this is where like the animosity between the two of them really pick up, which does make sense in a storyline perspective. You do have to realize this too. In addition to being the babyface Savage and the heel Heenan, they were feuding throughout all of 92 because Bobby Heenan was closely associated with Ric Flair. And that was the big world title feud. It was the world title match at WrestleMania 8, and it carried through the summer. So Randy Savage versus Bobby Heenan's crew is kind of a feud, and this match, the Luger Perfect match, is an extension of that feud that's been going on honestly since like 1991, if we're going to be totally honest here. So they're really at each other's throats here. And this match, though, on the other hand, certainly had the potential to be good. No real reason for these two guys not to gel in the ring, but they really didn't. Like, this should have been a quality match in the ring. Really was not, in my opinion. And this is the point where the show really hits like the skids, I think, you know, from here to the end. But what are your thoughts on the match?
Well, overall, this match sort of encompasses what I thought about the announcers throughout. And we'll start with the announcers, and then I'll get to the actual wrestlers. Because the Bobby Heenan shtick, it took a cycle for me, and it started out as funny when he's riding backwards on the elephant, and then they're saying that he smells, and he's making his little Bobby Heenan things where he's always for the bad guy and, you know, trying to cut the legs out from the good guy. I get all of that. Halfway through the episode, it got really old for me, and it peaked during this particular match where he's talking up Lex Luger to the point where, all right, Bobby, we get it. Like, every single comment, it just irked me and irritated me. But then somewhere right around the end of the match, I became okay with Bobby Heenan again. I sort of got the shtick. I started laughing along with the comments again. I don't know if the comments got better or if I just was more into it. But that's where we were for Bobby the Brain Heenan. And the Macho Man's great throughout. So nothing but love for him. So yeah, I mean, the more I think about it, I will remember Bobby the Brain Heenan and Macho Man and the gross ending of the actual show more than anything else that happened during this Mania.
Yeah, it is a highlight for me. And what you do have to realize, I know it got annoying, but that's also the gimmick, because Lex Luger at this point was still brought into the company by Bobby Heenan. Like, Bobby wasn't necessarily his manager, but he was like his big proponent. And the idea was that he was doing Heenan's bidding here in the feud with Mr. Perfect, taking over for Ric Flair, who Bobby had always been like behind. So that's kind of the reason why Bobby is extra Bobby in this match, because like it's like he's Luger's manager, so of course he's pulling for him extra hard in this one. So that's maybe the reason why it annoyed you for a little bit there. But yeah, this is, I think this is where their banter does really come to a peak, because at the end of the match, after Luger cheats to win, he knocks out Perfect with his loaded forearm, and leads to, you know, Savage being really angry because he's friends with Perfect in storyline, and of course Bobby's trying to defend Luger, and I'm not going to spoil where this goes, but it actually does have a storyline payoff of what's going on with Luger knocking people out, which we should also note for the point of the storyline earlier in the day, and this is pointed out at one point during the show, they did a WrestleMania brunch, which was actually a thing that they did every year for a long period of time. They did the WrestleMania brunch, and at the brunch, Luger knocked out Bret Hart for no apparent reason with the forearm, I guess just to be a dick, and he knocked out the WWF champ with his forearm. So they are sowing the seeds of a possible Bret Hart Lex Luger feud. And, you know, now we know that the Hitman not only has to go into a match against a 500-pound opponent, but he's going into it hurt after being knocked out by Luger earlier on in the day.
Well, this match, again, this to me was a stinker, but I don't know if I've ever in my entire life seen a match featuring Lex Luger that I've walked away from it going, yeah, that was a good match. I just feel like he's stiff and soulless and doesn't really have a whole lot of personality. And his gimmick is thrust upon him because they know that he's jacked and he's the epitome of, you know, masculine bodybuilding. But there's not a lot of there. You know what I mean? Like, it's everything about Lex Luger to me just sort of was like a, eh.
Well, Dave, everybody who's listening to this podcast that's like me and has been a fan for like 30 years just heard what you said and said, well, yeah, that's Lex Luger. You're pretty much right.
Well, as if that wasn't bad enough.
You hit it spot on there, buddy. May, if you're dying to see a good Lex Luger match, he does have a few good ones early on in his career in WCW when he is surrounded by the likes of Ric Flair and Arn Anderson and the Four Horsemen and Sting, and they somehow managed to get some good matches out of Lex. But no, you're 100% right. Lex Luger never exactly lit the world on fire by doing, you know, anything in the ring besides flexing.
Well, as if that wasn't a giant stiff taking over a match that we wish went differently. The next match, match number 7, might be the all-time greatest for that. Now, we can all understand how great The Undertaker is. Without him, I honestly don't know if wrestling would exist in the manner that it does today. The man is a legend. He's gifted in so many regards. His gimmick was great, even the biker angle of it. He is amazing. That said, The Undertaker managed to somehow pull a steaming turd into something that almost looked appealing with his match with Giant Gonzalez. And I emphasize almost, because as great as The Undertaker is, established, even he couldn't save this concept and this match.
Sorry, I had to chug my beer before I could talk about this one. Okay. So, I mean, there's been debate for years and years. You know, people will debate this all the time as wrestling fans, but I cannot wholeheartedly argue with you if you tell me this is the worst match in WrestleMania history. I think there was a time, if you want to search in the archives, and maybe I can link to it somewhere for our listeners, but if you're listening to us on The Place to Be, we on the site on placetobenation.com once spent a lot of time, and an inordinate amount of time, I should say. We spent like a year ranking every single match that ever happened at WrestleMania. And I'm reasonably certain this one was in the bottom 5, possibly the bottom 2. I can't be 100% certain, but the point is, it's hideous.
The whole build was bad and forced. The entrance was awkward and cheesy.
Well, I mean, The Undertaker does come out on like a chariot with a vulture. So, you know what? The only redeeming quality of this match is the friggin' vulture. Come on.
I will not say anything about The Undertaker's entrance, which I actually liked. I'm talking about Giant Gonzalez. The fact that, you know, we had to do the whole, oh, he's wobbling, up, oh, Undertaker's going back for an, he's almost gonna fall, he's almost taking the big man off of his feet. Like, I feel like we did about 3 of those spots in the middle of the match, and Giant Gonzalez, oh God, I can't. Long story short, this match was bad, established. I still love The Undertaker after it, even though I knew that it was sort of going to be weird because, again, I don't know exactly what happens in this match until I saw it, and I saw it tonight. But I do know, spoiler alert, that The Undertaker is undefeated at WrestleMania. So I kind of knew that he was going to defeat the Giant Gonzalez somehow. So when he didn't, I was surprised by that. Like, I thought that the undefeated streak didn't necessarily have an asterisk in it because of a disqualification from the Giant Gonzalez, which still technically would have made sense. But then the match ended with a DQ, and I'm like, wait, what? Okay, and then it kept going, and then obviously The Undertaker, after being knocked out with a chloroform rag, miraculously goes back to the back on a stretcher after being unconscious. storms back out due to, I'm sure, the magic of the urn that Paul Bearer is having, you know, help revive him. And then Bobby the Brain Heenan comes up with what might be the line of the entire pay-per-view: "You can't kill what's already dead." And the Undertaker comes back and, well, does his thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is another one where they maybe would have been better suited lapping about 10 minutes or so off of the old runtime here. But, like, I really do want you to think about this, because there's nothing we can say about the match. The match is terrible. Like, Giant Gonzalez is awful. I mean, he can't work. And Undertaker is, number one, bogged down by the gimmick, where he has to wrestle like a zombie. And number two, he's not that great at this point in his career either. So, I mean, this really is a struggle to get anything even resembling a respectable match out of these two. But I don't know if or what deity Vince McMahon may pray to when he goes to bed at night. But when he goes to bed at night, after swimming in his money bin like Scrooge McDuck, I hope he prays to a deity and thinks about how close he came to having so much less money in that money bin. Because, like, if you look at this match, and you really look at it from, like, you're looking at it with 2021 eyes here, but, like, think of how close The Undertaker probably came to getting booked to lose this match.
Yeah.
Like, they could have lost all the money they made on that Undertaker WrestleMania streak right here in this match early on so easily. In fact, it's almost like in the real timeline that happened, Undertaker lost this. And then at some point, Vince McMahon used his billions of dollars to make a time machine and go back in time and change the booking of this match so that Undertaker wins. And then he could have even more money in the future when he flies back into it. That's how close I think Undertaker came to losing this match. But it is crazy, and I think if we do other WrestleManias, there may be, like, another one or two where we're kind of saying, like, wow, it's amazing the streak actually did continue at this point before it was really a streak. But this one is really the closest call. They really lucked out, the fact that Undertaker actually won this match. But other than that, they were lucky. None of the rest of us were, because we had to watch it.
I just want to one more thing about this match, and then I swear to you, we will never, ever speak of it again.
Okay.
You said that you wished that they took 10 minutes off of the running time, and they did a better job with that. According to what I'm looking at, this match only lasted 7 minutes, 33 seconds.
I stand by what I said.
Well, after that steaming pile was done, now we get the main event that you came for. We've got the WWF Championship on the line with Yokozuna, the challenger, and Mr. Fuji and Bret Hart. And I got to say, I didn't hate the beginning and middle part of this. You're telling me it's the giant baby face at, you know, of the face of the company, the underdog. And I thought he did a really good job. Bret Hart, the consummate pro in all regards, of making Yokozuna look big and bad. Of Yokozuna taking some punishment and then giving a whole lot back, of Bret Hart taking a lot of punishment and then giving some back. I thought the match itself, knowing the physical limitations of Yokozuna, knowing the strengths of Bret the Hitman, I thought the match itself was fine. I didn't hate it at all. I will defend this match. It wasn't the greatest thing of all time. Like, it wasn't, you know, Ricky Steamboat and Macho Man or anything like that. But it did what it came to do. So for, you know, the 10 minutes that Yokozuna and Bret Hart were there, and they're going back and forth for the WWF Championship, I was in it. I was there. And Yokozuna getting the belt felt to me earned. They had a big build for this. The babyface lost in, you know, the heel cheated fashion and was robbed of his rightful place as champion. I got all of that. I was okay with this match.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, Bret pulls a miracle out of Yokozuna here. I mean, this match is, I'm not going to say it's great, but for what it is, I mean, It's actually, like, legitimately kind of great. Like, Bret pulls a great match, at least a respectable match out of Yokozuna. It's a lot of fun. And, yeah, I mean, it could have been, it was as good as it possibly could be. And Even the ending. Which involves Mr. Fuji throwing the salt in Bret Hart's eyes, and that helps Yokozuna get the win. Like, that's okay, because it helps Bret save a little bit of face,
right?
And Yokozuna, you know, gets the title. So then they did not leave well enough alone.
If they ended the pay-per-view there, I would have gone, all right, It wasn't a horrible pay-per-view. Like, it was a bad pay-per-view, but it wasn't absolutely dreadful. The belt changed hands. They made a lot of people angry, and I bet you all those people are going to tune in the next day on Raw to figure out what happened and to get some revenge. If they ended it here, Neil, if they ended it here, I would have been fine with it, and I thought that they were going to, and my finger was on the home button of my iPad going, all right, well, that's done. Okay, I don't really need to see the rest of the 10 minutes because there was like 10 minutes left. I don't really need to see the rest of the 10 minutes, which I'm sure is just going to be a whole lot of Macho posing and Macho Man and Bobby the Brain Heenan going back and forth and a couple of appearances and a lot of waving goodbyes and Yokozuna taunting the crowd and maybe even playing the national anthem for Japan. I'm like, I don't need to see the rest of this. It's okay. And then Hulk Hogan came out to console Bret Hart. And I'm like, what the hell is happening? Because now Mr. Fuji gets a microphone and Mr. Fuji starts screaming at Hulk Hogan, not just get out of here, you suck, he lost, get him out of here, you know, you're stupid, Japan rules. But now there's a challenge? What? You just got the belt, Mr. Fuji. You just had your boy win the championship. What are you doing?
I was so excited. I was so excited to hear your reaction to this whole run of nonsense when we got to this point, because I was gleeful when I found out you didn't know what happens, because it's mind blowing, isn't it?
Like, there's absolutely no rhyme or reason to I just won the belt and I'm going to challenge you. Like, from an outside perspective, does Vince have some sort of long-standing thing where he cannot let WrestleMania end with the bad guy winning? That's the only possible reason that this even remotely came close to making sense to me.
I mean, actually, yes. If you look at the history of WrestleMania, and it does not happen again until WrestleMania 2000, where coincidentally it is Vince's son-in-law who comes out as a heel and keeps his title at WrestleMania. Spoiler alert for everyone who's going to still be listening to us in 7 years when we do WrestleMania 2000.
Then.
But I mean, the babyface always wins at the end of WrestleMania. But I don't think that's an excuse for what happens here, which is, I mean, we didn't officially say it. I mean, yes, Fuji challenges Hulk Hogan to a match on the spot. It goes about, I don't know, 15 seconds. Fuji tries to throw salt at Hogan. Hogan ducks. It hits Yoko. Hulk hits him with a clothesline and the big leg, gets the pin, and Hulk Hogan leaves WrestleMania 9 as the WWF champion, which you did not know going into the show, but it is one of the most legendarily bad finishes to any pay-per-view of all time. There's no defending it, right? I mean, there's no, I mean, you,
nothing.
You, I mean, as a viewer, are you even watching Raw the next day after you see that?
If I'm the wrestling fan that I have been, I would be livid. I know Hulk Hogan's place in the business. I know how much of a legend he is. I give the man nothing but respect. He probably saved the entire industry at one point. There is no defending giving him the belt after 22 seconds after the buildup of the storyline with Bret Hart and Yoko, after Yokozuna winning in a fashion that would continue a feud and build throughout the entire summer, probably, you know, and Bret can win the belt back at SummerSlam or something like that. To have it turn on a dime with a nonsensical challenge, the worst part about this whole thing, to me, is that Bret Hart hears the challenge. Yokozuna challenging Hulk Hogan to a championship match right here, right now, let's go. And Bret Hart goes, okay, go for it, Hulkster. What the hell was that?
Well, I mean, at least in that regard, I can almost defend that, because of course Bret's pissed that this idiot just beat him, and now he's challenging another guy. I mean, if I'm Bret, I'd be like, yeah, go kick his ass too. Like, I don't necessarily fault him for that in the grand scheme of it. But yeah, I mean, it's so convoluted. It comes out of nowhere. Did you get the interview? Because there's been a lot of talk lately about Peacock editing certain offensive things out of the show.
I was going to say that.
Okay. Is the interview with Hogan on Peacock?
Yes, it is.
Does he use the racial stereotype?
And he specifically says, I don't care who wins, if it's USA or if it's the Jap, I'm going to come in for the challenge, brother. Yes, I got that interview.
I didn't want to say it. I guess Peacock standards and practices didn't quite notice that one. You got to think that's going to go at some point or not. But yes, there is an interview with Hogan where if you're watching this with kind of astute eyes for pro wrestling booking, you kind of start to get a little nervous when that interview comes out of nowhere. Because, I mean, Hogan's match was a couple matches ago. He has no reason to even still be there. He's interviewed by Mean Gene in his gear, in fresh gear, not in his gear he wore in the tag match, in new fresh gear. And he gives a big speech about how he's Bret Hart's friend, which is out of nowhere. And he warned Bret Hart about facing Yokozuna. And then, sure enough, here comes Hulk Hogan, Bret Hart's newfound friend, to challenge Yoko for the title at the end of the show. There's a couple things here that I'll tell you now that I didn't want to say in the build-up to the show because we were trying to be spoiler-free. And I was really trying to be spoiler-free once I found out you didn't know what happens. So it has always been assumed that this was simply Hogan playing politics and deciding, if I'm coming back to the WWF, I'm going to be the champion. Yeah, right. I'm not going to be anything else. Okay. Now, Bret Hart, in his book, which is Bret Hart, so we got to take it with a few grains of salt. Bret Hart claims that the story was supposed to be that Hogan would win the title here and they would build to Bret Hart versus Hulk Hogan at SummerSlam. And the idea was that then they would really crown Bret as the number one babyface in the promotion, and he was going to beat Hogan with the sharpshooter at SummerSlam. Now, there's no way in hell that was ever going to happen. I'm not saying that Vince didn't tell Bret that was what was going to happen, but that was never going to happen. What's come out recently, Hulk did an interview possibly on the Bruce Pritchard podcast, I want to say, within the last year, where Hogan claims the entire reason they did this was because there was a European tour coming up and ticket sales were really, really down. And they thought it would help ticket sales to promote Hulk Hogan as the world champion on the European tour. So they wanted to put the title on him here as a surprise. And then they were going to take it off of him down the road at one of the future shows. Now, the reason I'm going to tell you that that does not hold water is because I looked it up. And guess who does not actually wrestle on the European tour?
Well, that's because he broke his face with the Macho Man in a fight.
WWF champion Hulk Hogan is nowhere to be found. And it also doesn't explain why they simply couldn't headline the European tour shows with Hogan and Beefcake as the tag champs. And it doesn't explain why Hogan couldn't just be on the European tour as Hogan. That does not, I mean, do you think people in Spain were going to be like, well, you know, I really wanted to go to this WWF show with Hulk Hogan on it to see him wrestle, but oh, he's not the champ. I'm not buying a ticket then. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. But that's the story that he claims now. I mean, Hogan changes his stories all the time. That's the current story, was that he needed to have the title in order to boost sales for the European tour. None of that makes any sense. I mean, I think it's simply that Vince panicked, that the business was going down. We've covered the reasons why, the steroid trials, all the new people on top, all the old stars getting ushered out of the company. He panicked. Hogan was back. He decided we need to put the title on Hogan. And then, I mean, I don't know if I should kind of tell you what happens from here. I'm gonna, for the sake of this discussion, I'm not gonna tell you how the storyline ends.
Fine.
But I'm gonna tell you this, Dave. Do you wanna know how many times on the Chronology podcast we are going to discuss Hulk Hogan title matches on Raw?
A grand total of zero, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I don't even think the Hulkster appears on Raw outside of a recorded promo until he returns with the NWO in 2002. So, I mean, Hogan literally wins the title and vanishes from this point on. Now, we will get into all the details of why and what happens and where it goes from here. And there's a lot of twists and turns in the road. And I certainly hope we get to discuss them all sooner than later, depending on what Peacock does. But parting thoughts, Dave, on WrestleMania 9, because we have officially reached the end.
Overall, there were some highlights. I liked the Tatanka and Shawn Michaels match. I love Macho and Bobby the Brain Heenan on the announcing. I thought Jim Ross did an incredible job, both introducing himself to the company, to the fans, and carrying the entire pay-per-view as the main announcer. I thought he did a great job. I have more respect for The Undertaker. I have more respect for Bret Hart. I have more respect for even Razor Ramon. and the rest of the show can go straight to hell where it came from.
Yeah. It's not the wrestler's fault. It's just the booking. It's just a badly booked show. They booked themselves into too many corners. They tried to get too cute with certain stuff like the chloroform rag and that wacky finish to the IC title match. And, you know, I mean, with the benefit of hindsight, I'm sure they don't book the show the same way. I'm certain that if they had 100 other chances to book this show, they would do it, you know, 99 different ways in the way they did it, and they would all be better. It was just a strikeout. It still holds a special place in my heart because I love the commentary and I love the characters and I love this era. And I will tell you this, that as much of a stinker as it is, you know, there's something you missed, Dave. You know, you're supposed to be a journalist and you missed this. I can't believe you're not bummed out. You mean when Hogan was posing in the ring, you weren't thinking, well, I mean, there's still another match left. We missed a match.
Whoa.
Bigelow and Kamala got dropped from the card. It never happened.
Ugh.
And throughout my youth, watching this show 100 times on Coliseum Video, Hulk Hogan posing with the title in the ring as Bobby Heenan yells, "Wait a minute, I don't understand. Who's the champion?" was not the way the show ended, because the Coliseum Video version of this actually bothered to explain the absence of the Bam Bam Bigelow Kamala match with a 10-second clip of Kamala backstage in his Kamala outfit and his face paint, speaking his Kamala gibberish, his to the elephant and the camel who appeared in the opening procession with a crawl underneath that said that the Bam Bam Bigelow Kamala match did not take place because Kamala was busy spending time with his fellow countrymen.
Oh, no.
And that is how they explained the lack of match and how the Coliseum Video ended. And I think that is the perfect bow to put on top of our WrestleMania 9 edition of Chronology.
We need to, just for tradition's sake, we need to name an MVP. I'm going to tell you right now that it goes to the Macho Man. I thought he was incredible throughout. Neil, of WrestleMania 9, you've seen it 100 times. Who is your most valuable player?
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, if I've got to give it to one guy, I'm going with the Brain. I think it should be triple co-MVPs for JR, Savage, and Heenan. And if people think that's a cop-out, I will say my in-ring MVP is Bret Hart. But my official number one MVP is Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Okay. There you have it. It's Chronology for WrestleMania 9. Let us all shower down, hose off, and never speak of this again. Thank you, Neil.
Dave and I, we are legit very good friends off the air, and we do live very close to each other, so we will speak. We will hopefully see one another, but we also hope we will speak to you all out there in Radio Land. I'm thanking you for being a part of Chronology. We didn't even really get a chance to push this podcast as hard as we wanted to. My goal was to get 10 episodes out there to the folks and then really start a hard push of promoting the show, because I figured after 10 shows, we should know what we're doing. We made it 10 shows before all the shows got pulled from the network, so I don't know when we're going to get to start pushing the show. I don't know when we're going to get to record more shows. We hope it's going to be sooner than later. If things really drag on, we may come up with an alternate plan. I mean, we may have to just jump into Raw in 97 or whenever it is that they're on the network. But I really, really want to accomplish our goal of doing every single show, at least as far as we can get before we literally go into a nursing home. But I don't know if we're going to be able to do it, though. I mean, it is promising that they just uploaded, like, legitimately about 15 years of Raw all at once, and they've only got a few more to go. And none of these are offensive where they've got to be editing stuff out, really. I mean, they're offensive in the ring because they suck, but they're not offensive. Like, they uploaded all those Attitude Era shows that have, like, Mae Young giving birth to a hand and Val Venus getting his pee-pee chopped off with a samurai sword. So if standards and practices allow those things, then I got to think that these 93, 94, 95 Raws are coming soon. And once they're there, folks, we are with you for the long haul on Chronology.
At the very least, can we just make a promise that whatever pay-per-views come and go, we'll at least do the pay-per-views if we have access to them.
So wait a minute. Are we saying that if it's June and we have not done a Chronology, we're just going to skip the ones in between and we're going to do the King of the Ring?
Sounds about right. We will do what we can.
Well, I hope it doesn't come to that, because there's actually good Raws coming up. and if we ever get to watch them. But we'll see what happens. Just if you're subscribing to us, just keep your subscription. If you're following us, you know, on Facebook or whatever, just keep doing that. And, you know, there's going to be new shows at some point. Worst comes to worst, maybe we'll just do another special show on something different. Dave, you never watched that Royal Rumble 93, so maybe we'll have to do that one in a month. I don't know.
True. And let's just end on worst came to worst, and it was named the Giant Gonzalez. That's been Chronology. I'm Dave Thackera. He's Neil Trauma. We will see you at some point in the future.
Take it easy.